My name is Casey Dolan, and I'm a summer intern with Children's Ministry. And this morning's scripture reading comes from the book of Nehemiah, chapter 9, verses 13 through 21, and that's found on page 480 of the Red Bibles provided. Nehemiah 9, verses 13 through 21. You came down on Mount Sinai. You spoke to them from heaven. You gave them regulations and laws that are just and right, and decrees and commands that are good. You made known to them your holy Sabbath and gave them commands, decrees, and laws through your servant Moses. In their hunger, you gave them bread from heaven, and in their thirst, you brought them water from the rock. You told them to go in and take possession of the land you had sworn with uplifted hand to give them. But they, our forefathers, became arrogant and stiff-necked and did not obey your commands. They refused to listen and failed to remember the miracles you performed among them. They became stiff-necked and in their rebellion, appointed a leader in order to return to their slavery. But you are a forgiving God, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love. Therefore, you did not desert them, even when they cast for themselves an image of a calf and said, "This is your God, who brought you up out of Egypt," or when they committed awful blasphemies. Because of your great compassion, you did not abandon them in the desert. By day, the pillar of cloud did not cease to guide them on their path, nor the pillar of fire by night to shine on the way they were to take. You gave them your good spirit to instruct them. You did not withhold your manna from their mouths, and you gave them water for their thirst. For 40 years you sustained them in the desert. They lacked nothing, their clothes did not wear out, nor did their feet become swollen. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated.
Well, as you've gathered, it's been an exciting week, and we didn't want it to end, and that's why we have Family Sunday, so kids are welcome. And Holly said it in the beginning, wiggles and giggles and all, we're really glad that your children are in here right now. So don't worry about a few noises or throwing paper airplanes. No, don't do that. But we're excited that our children are in here with us. My wife and I love it when our kids are in service with us, and we've got a lot of kids in service with us. So don't feel like you got to pick up your loud kid and walk out of the room. We're all going to be in this together. I got three boys, so background noise is, I'm used to it, all right? So I just want to make that disclaimer as we begin, because a lot has happened at VBS this week, and we wanted to pause from our Genesis series this week to make sure that we could share with you some of the things that we've been learning. And really, what I wanted to share are some things that I've been learning. Let me give you one picture from this week, just if you didn't get it during the singing today. That was our Friday night celebration, and those are all of our kids and leaders on the stage singing their songs. It was a wild, wonderful week. And so often when we teach children, we think, how do I make this simple, right? How do we talk about God's mighty power? And of course, we use things like Everest Base Camp to set the scene for these dynamic principles that we want to teach these kids, these truths that we want them to hold on to. But sometimes I think as adults, and I did it this week, we think, oh yeah, let's make it real simple, right? And we go, oh, this is so simple. But one thing I've been convicted of this week is that so often we go, well, hey, it may be a simple truth, but the application is pretty profound. That often we find things in Scripture and we go, yeah, that sounds simple, love your neighbor. But when Jesus talks about it, well, it's actually a very profound statement. That the application in our lives is huge. This week, as we talked about God's power, we talked about five things. We talked about how God has the power to provide. That's good. None of the kids yelled, hold on. All week, we've trained them to yell, hold on. So thanks for not yelling, hold on. First service, all the kids broke out yelling. Anyway, God has the power to comfort. God has the power to heal. That's good. We'll do it two more times, and then we're done. God has the power to forgive. God has the power to love us forever. These were the truths that we wanted our kids to leave with at the end of the week. And every day, my wife Susie and I, we were sort of the skit crew. We were making sure that as the kids entered every morning for Base Camp Everest, that they would be introduced to the theme for the day. So we took on the role of two different characters. That's my wife, Summit Susie, and I was Rock Climber Rich. I'm in my pajamas that day because I overslept and missed the hike up Everest. But anyway, Summit Susie, Rock Climber Rich, and every night before VBS, we would put together our skit for the next morning. We had a script, but we always altered the script because it wasn't quite wild and crazy enough for us. So we add a little Sylvester spice to it. But as we went over these themes and we talk about them, we even looked at the first one. God has the power to provide. Now, it sounds like a simple thing. Oh, yeah, God has the power to provide. But when my wife and I really started asking each other, do we live like God has the power to provide? I mean, we're already freaking out about college tuition, you know, 15 years from now. Or can I rest assured that God has the power to provide? So these simple themes really have deep application in our lives. On day two, we talked about God having the power to comfort. And our Bible verse for the day was, God comforts us in our time of troubles so that we can comfort others. And we challenged the kids. We said, you know, we want to introduce you to one of our global partners. Here at the chapel, we partner with a pastor in Congo, Bishop Desiree, and he has 19 churches in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And one of his ministries is feeding centers for kids that are the same age as the kids that were here at VBS. And we said, if it's really true that God can comfort us so that we can comfort others, we have an idea. We want you to bring in all the change that you can find in your house. You know, go through your mom and dad's car. How many of you have change in your car that you've lost? Yes. Go through the cushions in your couch. Root through your mom's purse. We didn't really say that. But go find all the change you can and bring it in. And we thought that would be a great way for the kids to practice comforting others. Well, by the end of the week, we had over $1,500 in change that the kids brought in. And when I sat down with one of the kids, he said, Rock Climber Rich, because I am a celebrity now. Even had some photos taken in the supermarket after VBS. But anyway, I'll be Rock Climber Rich for the rest of the year until next year's VBS, and then I'll get a new name. I was Ranger Rich last year. Anyway, so I sat down with one of the kids, and he said, Rock Climber Rich, I want to tell you something. I said, yeah. He goes, last night I opened up my piggy bank, and I took half the money that I had in it, and I brought it in for the kids in Congo. And I thought, man, I have so much to learn from these kids. Because that kid believes that God will provide. That kid believes that God will use him to comfort and heal others. And he's living it out, maybe better than I am. Well, something really hit me on day four. My character, Rock Climber Rich and Summit Susie, we were in the middle of our skit. And the skit was something like this. I had been sick on day two. And on day three, I got my whole expedition sick. You know how you're supposed to sneeze and cough, right? Into your arm. Well, I wasn't doing that, and it ended up that my whole expedition team was sick, and they were angry at me. And so I started the skit by hiding throughout the room. I was hiding behind chairs, and kids were pulling at my hat and on my jacket. And Summit Susie was saying, Rock Climber Rich, why are you hiding? And I was explaining that my expedition team was angry at me, and I didn't want to have to go see them. I didn't want to have to face the problem that I had created. And Summit Susie asked me a question. She said, Rock Climber Rich, is your plan that you're just going to hide forever? Well, it was a weird thing that happened because even in character in that moment, even as Rock Climber Rich hiding behind a chair back there, all of a sudden I realized that when I sin, I often hide. That my response to my own sin is to hide. And I thought, that's not a good response. It reminded me of something that happened when I was 4 years old. So here's a story for you kids out there. But my dad had this giant wooden desk in our living room. It was this beautiful antique desk. When my parents first got married, they traveled to their favorite furniture store in Cooperstown, New York, and they bought this giant antique wooden desk. And it was sort of the start of them together as a couple. And this big desk sat in our living room at home. And I loved this desk. I loved the way it looked and felt and even smelled. And I loved that I could open the drawers and my dad would have all sorts of weird things in the drawers. He had buffalo head nickels and wheat pennies. And he had little wooden boxes that were filled with trinkets from his travels or his time in Vietnam or different things. And I was just mesmerized by all the things that I could find in my dad's big old wooden desk. Well, one day as I was playing powerful businessman at his desk and opening and closing drawers, I noticed that there were some nails. I hadn't noticed those in the drawer before, so I took out some finishing nails. They were about 2 inches long, and I was sort of playing with the nails and looking at them. And then I opened up another drawer, and there was a hammer. And a four-year-old looks at nails and a hammer and says, now all I need is a block of wood, right? And I'm looking around, and then I realize, hey, this desk is made out of wood. So I take those nails and that hammer, and I just start pounding them into the desk. And I was 4 years old, but I can remember this like it was yesterday. I'm pounding those nails into the desk and making a sort of line of them, right? Making a line of nails. And I get about four nails in, and I realize, oh, no. What did I just do? Right? So I turn that hammer around. I take that rough, scratchy metal end with that claw, and I start yanking those nails out of that desk, and I make more of a mess. And I start thinking through my options in that moment, right? I put the nails back in this drawer. I put the hammer back in that drawer, and I'm staring at these holes and these scratches, and I think, okay, I better just run away. No, I can't run away. Okay, I'm going to try to cover this up. I remember running to the bathroom. I get some wet toilet paper, and I come back, and I'm, like, wiping it down. And for a minute, it's all shiny and glossy and nice again, and then the water evaporates, and it's a messed up patch on the desk again. Well, I can't cover this one up. Then I get a bright idea. I'll just blame it on my sisters, right? I had three older sisters. I'll just blame it on them. But, no, they're smarter and stronger, and they'll band together as they always did. So I can't do that. They'll throw me under the bus for sure. Well, maybe I can just go tell my mom. She's a reasonable lady. I'll just tell my mom what happened. But no, that didn't seem like the plan either. So I just decided I would wait to see what happens. And even 35 years later, I can remember the pit in my stomach all day long waiting for my dad to come home from work. It's the same pattern every day. He walked in the door, put down his briefcase, took off his coat, hung it in the coat closet, picked his briefcase back up, walked into the living room where his desk was, sat down at his desk and started going through the day's mail. I mean, it happened every day. And sure enough, around 5:30, that happened. Dad came home, put his suitcase down, put his coat in the closet, picked his suitcase back up, walked through the living room to his desk and sat down. And I remember just waiting outside the living room. Is he going to see the holes in his desk? And sure enough, all of a sudden, kids, children, Kim, Britton, Elizabeth, Richard, make your way to the living room. Now, I've sort of exaggerated in my mind, right? To me, it was a little bit like The Sound of Music, like he blew the whistle and, you know, my sister Kim lined up and then my sister Britton lined up and there was Elizabeth and there was a spot for me next. And it wasn't quite that dramatic, but I remember watching my sisters go to the side of my dad's desk and I was panicked. So what did I do? What any smart four-year-old would do? I dove under the love seat. I love this love seat. It had just about enough clearance for me to get underneath of it. Nobody else in the family could fit. I was still the skinny one, so I could get underneath it. And I dove under the love seat and I hid. I was 10 feet from my dad's desk. It wasn't a great hiding place. But I remember my dad, sort of ignoring the fact that I was hiding under the love seat, just asked each of my sisters, Kim, do you know anything about the holes in my desk? No, Dad. Britton? No, Dad. Elizabeth? No, Dad. And I remember sort of when he asked Elizabeth, my one that's closest to me in age, Liz, do you know anything about the holes in the desk? She sort of goes, I bet he does. And they all looked over and there are my feet hanging out from underneath the love seat. And my dad dismissed my sisters and I felt like an eternity before he made his way over to the love seat, right? I'm just under there thinking something, you know, something great's got to happen right now. I don't know what. My dad came over and he just sat down by the love seat. He said, can you come out from underneath there? And to this day, I don't remember getting punished. I don't remember getting yelled at. I don't remember getting any consequences. I just remember the question my dad asked me. He said, why didn't you just tell me what you did? Why didn't you just tell me what you did? That's a big question. I'll tell you why. I was scared out of my mind. I was hiding under the love seat. But Summit Susie's question is a good one. Is our plan that we're just going to hide there under the love seat forever? We've been studying Genesis, and as I was looking at this passage in Nehemiah, I was thinking a little bit about Genesis and thinking about our response to our own sin. You see, Doug talked about it last week. We have the Garden of Eden, right? And in the center of the garden, we have two trees. Let's see how well you listened last week. We have the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Okay, kids, you saw your parents. If they got it right, give them a high five. If they got it wrong, elbow them. Good job. All right, lots of high fives. Good. So we got two trees in the middle of the Garden of Eden. And last week, I've read Genesis tons of times. It was the first time I realized that both trees were in the middle of the garden. I imagine them now growing right next to each other. In chapter 2, God said, hey, Adam, if you want to eat from the tree of life, eat all you want. It's going to give you life. But he said to Adam, but this other tree, the knowledge of good and evil, so don't eat any fruit from that tree. If you do, you will surely die. Right there in the middle of the garden, there's the choice. Do I want to live or do I want to die? Isn't this the choice we have all the time in our life? I mean, at night at 9 o'clock, I go to the refrigerator, I open up the doors. I can eat celery or I can eat ice cream. I can choose life or I can choose death. I'm lactose intolerant, so I go for the brownies. But we can choose life or we can choose death. And this decision happens all around us all the time. How we treat our spouse, we can choose life or we can choose death. How we interact with our kids or our parents or our coworkers. How we spend our time and our money. Things we do in private or public. We can choose life or we can choose death. But like Adam and Eve, sometimes we choose death. That serpent came and tempted Eve and Adam, and they ate from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and God said, you will surely die. They chose death. And what was interesting to me is their reaction when they chose death. See, the Bible tells us in Genesis 3, you can turn there if you want. I'll sort of paraphrase as we go through, but I'll be in chapter 3, verse 7 and following for a minute. But in Genesis chapter 3, it says, as soon as they ate that fruit, their eyes were opened and they felt shame. They saw their nakedness and shame overwhelmed them. So what did they do? They tried to cover it up. They made some clothes out of fig leaves, not the appropriate clothing, but they went for it anyway. And then when God came later in chapter 3 to spend time with them, they got scared. They were afraid. So what did they do? They jumped under the love seat. They hid in the bushes. And when God came and confronted them and said, Adam and Eve, what happened? They said, it was Satan's fault. It was the serpent's fault. They blamed somebody else. This week, as I was thinking about God's power to forgive and thinking about what I was going to learn from VBS and share with you guys, I was amazed because these are the reactions to sin that so often we have and the reactions that lead to death. Shame, cover up, fear, hiding, blame. And kids, they do exactly that, right? All of a sudden the living room goes silent and you wonder, uh-oh, what just happened? You walk in and one of your kids is sort of hiding behind the rocking chair. You're going, something happened. Then you turn a little bit more and there's marker all over the wall, right? Kids hide for real. As adults, we get a little smoother about how we hide. We get extra busy at work, or we go do a house project that means we don't have to interact with our wife or our spouse that we're having problems with. We hide behind alcohol or drugs or different things. We hide, or maybe we play the blame game. We sin, we sin against somebody or somebody against God, and we blame it on something or someone. It was because I was tired. That's why I was such a jerk. It was because, something happened to me in the past, and that's why I'm responding the way I am now. We blame. We have fear. We try to cover it up so that nobody sees. Our shame builds up inside of us, and we get angry and depressed. What do you do? How do you respond to sin? Do any of those resonate with you? I'm totally a hider. When I know I've offended somebody, I just run from them. If you don't know what you do, just look to your spouse and say, hey, which one of those do I do? And they'll tell you which one of those you do. But I'm convinced that in our response to sin, we do one of those. And those responses lead to death. On day 4 in VBS, our theme was God has the power to forgive. And we looked at a verse in Nehemiah that said, our God is a God of forgiveness. You are a God of forgiveness. Nehemiah 9:17. That God is a God of forgiveness. Well, this morning, Casey read from chapter 9 of Nehemiah. And this week, I was studying Nehemiah. If you don't know the book of Nehemiah well, basically, Nehemiah is a book about rebuilding the walls and the gates of Jerusalem. You see, years past, Jerusalem was ransacked. It was brought to the ground. The temple was destroyed. The walls were ripped down. The big wooden gates of the city were burned to ashes. Jerusalem is in ruins. Ezra, the book of Ezra, right before Nehemiah, is a recount of rebuilding the temple. And Nehemiah is a story about rebuilding the walls and the gates. But rebuilding walls and gates is really just the facade of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is about rebuilding a community. It's about rebuilding relationships. It's about rebuilding the people's connection with God. Yes, God raised up Nehemiah to go and rebuild the walls and the gates of Jerusalem, but really, God raised up Nehemiah to rebuild his people. They had been scattered all throughout the land. They were dying. Their relationships were ruined. They were lonely and scared, and they were hiding under love seats. And God sent Nehemiah to bring them out of hiding, and to give them a roadmap to restoration. See, the book of Nehemiah, yes, it's about rebuilding walls, but it's about rebuilding our relationships. And the book of Nehemiah is about confession. Nehemiah begins with his own personal confession in chapter 1. He kneels before the Lord and he confesses his sins and the sins of his community, and he asks for God's forgiveness. And God gives him a plan after that and says, you are going to go and help me rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, but really, we're going to rebuild my people. See, the right response to sin is Nehemiah's response to sin. And the verses we read this morning are his road to restoration, his desire for us, that when we sin against God and we sin against others, we follow this formula. In chapter 9, verse 13 through 17, it reads like this, and I'm going to skip around a little bit. You came down on Mount Sinai, you spoke to them from heaven, you gave them regulations and laws that are just and right, and decrees and commands that are good. But they, our forefathers, became arrogant and stiff-necked and did not obey your commands. They refused to listen. Nehemiah's roadmap to restoration and rebuilding begins with confession. It begins with honest confession of sin. See, we're pretty good at dishonest or not so good confession, right? We do things like this. Susie, I'm so sorry that you were offended by what I said. I was just really tired. That is not a confession. Confession is, Susie, I acted like a complete jerk, and I am so sorry. I'm sorry that I hurt you. Will you please forgive me? That we begin with an honest confession, not a confession that puts blame on somebody, not a confession that's full of cover-up, not a confession that's about hiding, but a confession that's out in the open. Chapter 9, the people of Israel are standing on the steps of the city, out in the open, confessing their sin, saying, God, your ways are right, and what I did was wrong. You told me to eat from the tree of life, and I ate from the tree that leads to death. Our road to restoration begins with honest confession. But it's rooted in God's great character. In our next verse, we see that we can trust God. That as we confess our sins, we can trust in God. Nehemiah writes, but you are a forgiving God,
gracious, compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love.
Do you ever get nervous that when you confess to God that somehow he's going to be mad at you and strike you with a lightning bolt or make you get in a car accident or have you chop your finger off in the kitchen? Like, we don't realize that God is a loving, compassionate, wonderful, forgiving God. And what he wants to do is what my dad did when I was hiding under the love seat. He sits down and he says, "Why didn't you just tell me what you did?" My dad saw the holes on that desk and he knew instantly Richard did that. God knows when we're doing what's right or wrong. He's with us. And he wants a relationship with us.
Our God is gracious and compassionate. He is a forgiving God. He is slow to anger. And he just wants you to tell him what you did.
Nehemiah's roadmap to restoration begins with confession. It's rooted in trust of who God is. But then it demands that we follow. So often in our sin, we try to figure out how we're going to get ourselves out of it, right? We've landed ourselves in a tough spot. Our wife's mad at us. We're in the doghouse, and we think, "I know how I'll get out of this." But Nehemiah says, this isn't about you figuring out how to get out of this. This is about you following God out of the mess you created.
Verse 19 and following, "Because of your great compassion, you did not abandon them in the desert. By day, the pillar of cloud did not cease to guide them on their path, nor the pillar of fire by night to shine on the way they would take. You gave your good spirit to instruct them. You did not withhold your manna from their mouths, and you gave them water for their thirst. For 40 years, you sustained them. They lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out, nor did their feet become swollen."
When we realize what we've gotten ourselves into and the depth of our sin, and we confess our sin, we trust in God, the next step is that we follow his plan out of the mess. For 40 years, God led his people from slavery to the promised land, from slavery to freedom, from death to life. And it was a tough journey. But not once did they thirst for anything. Not once were they hungry. Their clothes didn't even wear out. When we make clothes, we make them out of fig leaves. They don't last long. When God gives us clothes, they don't wear out. And our feet don't become swollen and bruised. When we find ourselves in the depth of our sin, we confess, we trust, and we follow because Jesus has the right way out of the mess we've created. This week, I thought a lot about how I respond to sin and the unhealthy ways that I respond to sin. But I am struck by Nehemiah's journey for us. Confession, trust, and following. Silly thing happened at work this week. The sixth graders were leaving for their missions trip to Norfolk. That's not the silly thing. But they got together Thursday morning to get all the vans and the chapel buses ready, and they went out to start the chapel buses and to move them into the place they needed them, and they realized they were missing one of the chapel buses. They said, "Well, what's going on?" They looked on the computer. They had signed it out months and months ago, and so they started looking around the parking lot. Where's the chapel bus? I mean, nobody wants to steal a chapel bus. It's got to be somewhere. They contacted campus services, and campus services says, "No, the chapel bus is down in Norfolk getting serviced." He said, no, we need the bus to get to Norfolk. I said, "Well, we didn't see it in the computer that way." And there was this tension. Who messed up? Where'd the bus go? Student ministry's team got into action quickly and rented some minivans and borrowed some minivans and made sure everything was going to be okay. But everybody's sort of wondering, how did that happen?
Well, not more than an hour after this all transpired, a bunch of us on staff got an email from one of the student ministry staff members. She wrote this. "It was apparent that today's issue was a user error on my part. Please accept my apologies for the last-minute strain this created for each of you. What can I say? This one is mine to own. I am truly sorry."
Well, I read that email from the staff member, and I thought, wow, that was impressive. I know what I would have done. I would have ran into the woods and hid until this whole scenario had blown over. Or maybe I would have tried to enter the reservation back into the computer and post-date it like 6 months ago. Or maybe I would have gotten really loud with campus services, just said, it's your fault. You should have asked us before you brought the van down to Norfolk. No, there was no shame or hiding or cover up or blaming or fear. Just a wonderful email that owned the mistake. And then Travis responded, and I loved Travis' email. He wrote, thank you for owning the error. Ownership of our mistakes is a big value for me because it's a sign of health and trust on a team. People own things when they are mature and trust that when they own things, they won't get crushed for an innocent mistake. So all I want to say is thank you for owning the issue. That's a great sign of your maturity and the trust we have built over the past couple years as a staff team. We are all in this together. I know it will be my mistake that will cause others to find ways to overcome next time. This week, Summit Susie asked rock climber Rich a question. Is your plan that you're just going to hide there forever? Are you hiding? Are you covering up? Are you blaming others? Are you so scared or filled with shame because of sin in your life? Nehemiah reminds us this morning that the road to restoration begins with confession. It's rooted in trust in who God is. And it leads with following his path out of the mess that we've created. Will you get out from underneath the love seat with me this week and confess and trust and follow? Because the plan to hide forever really doesn't work.